Welcome to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast, proudly presented by Butler Snow, where we cover topics of interest to lawyers handling appellate matters in Texas courts and beyond. This podcast demystifies appellate law and pulls back the curtain on the appellate system through conversations with judges, court staff, and top trial and appellate practitioners. Listen in to discover best practices and tips for successfully presenting your case, managing your docket, and promoting efficiency through legal technology. And now, here are your hosts, Todd Smith and Jody Sanders.
Welcome back. You're listening to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast. I'm Jody Sanders.
And I'm Todd Smith.
And our guest today is Hannah Mullen, who's a staff attorney at CARE LDF. Hannah, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Jody and Todd, for having me. I'm very excited to be here.
Well, I guess first, I said CARE LDF. Our listeners probably don't know what that is because it's a lot of letters. Can you explain what CARE LDF is?
Sure. CARE LDF is the acronym for the Council on American Islamic Relations Legal Defense Fund. CARE, the Council on American Islamic Relations, is the leading advocacy group for American Muslims. And LDF, the Legal Defense Fund, is the civil rights litigating arm of the organization. I focus on litigating civil rights cases in the federal courts on behalf of the American Muslim community. And I'm not obligated, I suppose, nobody ordered me to say this, but I feel compelled to say that nothing I'm going to say today represents the views of CARE LDF, and I speak only for myself, with the exception of saying, if you're a member of the American Muslim community and you're experiencing religious discrimination, we have a form on our website and we would love to hear from you. And also, if you're a civil rights-minded college or law student, please apply to intern with us. Now it's back to just me.
That is great. We very much appreciate that. Well, if you would just kind of tell our listeners a little bit about yourself, your background, who you are.
Sure. I grew up in the DC area. I suppose before I went to law school, my life was somewhat dominated by sports. I played 4 years of college lacrosse. I played year-round lacrosse 11 months out of the year from the time I was 9 until the time I was 22, and sort of snuck school in when I could. When I went to law school my first year, I thought it was somewhat funny that everyone was so overwhelmed by work because I thought it was really neat that I had extra time to do extracurriculars, which was something I'd really never done before. Now I've been able to shift my life for the past decade or so into full nerd mode, which I very much enjoyed. So I graduated from law school in 2019. I clerked for a year and then I moved on to public interest practice that I'm sure we'll talk about in more detail.
Before we get kind of into your legal career, we do have to take a pause to talk about your family. You come from a very legal family, and we wanted to talk a little bit about your grandfather for a minute and just kind of your reflections and maybe some personal stories about him.
I've actually been thinking about Grandpa a lot recently. There's an upcoming event at Northwestern where they've dedicated a courtyard to him. He was an alum of Northwestern Law, and they've dedicated a courtyard to him. They commissioned this beautiful bust. I'm giving a little talk there actually this coming week, and I've been thinking a lot about sort of my relationship to him as his granddaughter, but also as my mother was his only child to follow him into the law, and I'm the only grandchild to follow him into the law.
We should clarify who your grandfather is exactly.
Oh, I apologize.
I want to make sure that our listeners understand before you launch into what I'm sure is going to be a wonderful reflection on that connection.
I'm lucky enough to be the granddaughter of Justice John Paul Stevens. It's interesting, you know, when I was growing up, he retired from the bench at 90 years old when I was in high school. I think I was a senior in high school at the time, or maybe had just graduated when he retired. My consciousness of the law and becoming an attorney did not overlap with him actually being active on the bench. I think my consciousness when he was actually on the bench was, Grandpa has an interesting job. There's a picture of him in my fifth grade history book. Sometimes he makes the news, but it was pretty abstract. And he's a really humble guy, was not lording it over people. He was just my grandpa. And we hung out and played ping pong together and talked about books. It didn't really enter my consciousness as much until I got older. And I think I got to know really Justice Stevens much in the way that my law school classmates did, because I read his opinions. And it was actually very moving to realize that the man I admired as kind and thoughtful and humble came across as kind and thoughtful and humble in his writing too. And I really admired the values that I saw him live as my grandpa, and I saw them coming through in his jurisprudence as well. So it was almost like two different stages of getting to know my grandpa and then getting to know Justice Stevens later as an adult.
Yeah, I think it speaks really well of him that you really knew him only as grandpa. And that wasn't such a huge part of his identity within his family, you know, being a U.S. Supreme Court justice. That's really neat. And then now to be able to read his opinions as a law student and as a practicing attorney and see that deeper level of thinking that he went through in his job every day and appreciate that from a professional's perspective. So that's really cool.
I've had a couple opportunities to cite his opinions as authority for advocating on behalf of my clients. Most recently, I argued in my role as a clinical fellow at the Appellate Courts Immersion Clinic at Georgetown, I argued a case about whether my client could bring a claim under the Americans with Disabilities Act, and that had a constitutional implication around the abrogation under Section 5 of the 14th Amendment of the state's 11th Amendment immunity. And the leading case that was relevant to that analysis was his opinion in Tennessee versus Lane. And so really reading and thinking about Tennessee versus Lane in the briefing and in preparing for argument, I was very moved to see how his work was hitting the ground and operating to hopefully make the lives of people with disabilities better right now, today.
It's just an amazing connection to be able to form in your career.
And no pressure on you and your career. I don't know if word got out when you were in law school that he was your grandfather.
I wasn't sneaky. I wasn't hiding anything, but it was nice that we didn't share a last name, I think. And even Stevens, I mean, it's not a particularly distinctive last name, but Mullen, a little bit of separation there was helpful. And I think the fact that he was retired too, I could sort of try to slip by. I think word got out a couple semesters in, but I think I was fairly successful at evading the, hey, there goes that girl thing. At least I think so. I don't know. Maybe I'm wrong.
Well, we also want to talk about, you did a clerkship with another judge whose name is pretty familiar these days as well, Judge Merrick Garland. Would you mind just maybe telling us a little bit about your clerkship?
It was a fantastic experience. He is a wonderful boss and a deeply kind person. And I got very lucky with co-clerks. The four of us were close and really enjoyed each other's company. And it was just a fantastic year. I thought for many years that I wanted to be a government attorney. And when I applied for clerkships, I was really focused on the DC circuit for that reason. And it's kind of funny where I ended up now. You know, I'm not doing a lot of FERC litigation these days. Subject matter aside, I think it was a really useful experience because he's so rigorous and incisive with how he thinks about cases. And it was a very verbal job. You had to ask permission. We didn't write bench memos. We wrote these three-page memos called cover memos that were designed for him to read first before he read the briefs himself and to sort of identify the most important parts of the record and the case law. And then he would read those and they would have our preliminary conclusions about how we thought the case should shake out. And then he would read that, he would read the briefs, he would read the parts of the record. His office was sort of down the hall and around the corner from the row of clerk's offices. And he would call you on our phone and basically cold call you, which was terrifying until you got used to it and you realized that he's the nicest guy on earth. He's not going to care if you say, Judge, I'm going to double check that and call you back in a couple minutes. That was fine. That was one of the most important tips I got from previous clerks was it's going to feel like he's quizzing you. He's not. He just wants to have a conversation. I would jump out of my seat every time the phone rang. But then he would just want to hash things out, or he would come, he would walk down the line of clerk's offices and poke his head in and start asking you questions about the different cases. And he really took seriously what the clerks thought, which was felt like a big responsibility. And he just, you know, he ate lunch with us almost every day. He was very, very sweet.
Attorneys are always trying to figure out the best, most efficient ways to stay on top of their game. Use QuickCheck on Westlaw Edge, a first-of-its-kind intelligent document analysis tool, to discover a new level of confidence. Simply upload a brief, yours or your opponent's, and in just minutes receive a report with warnings for cited authority, recommendations for additional relevant authority, as well as authority that is contrary to what your opponent cited. Improve the quality and thoroughness of your work without sacrificing time with QuickCheck on Westlaw Edge.
Did you have caller ID on that phone to know that it was a judge?
You knew when he was reviewing your cases. You knew when you were on deck.
And your phone probably otherwise didn't ring very often in the office. So if it rang, it was a pretty good bet, I suppose, that it was the judge.
It's the judge, and he's spotted something you didn't.
It sounds almost like you kind of extended law school for a whole other year. You kept getting cold called and asked questions about cases and everything.
Yeah, it was funny too. He had, because he'd been on the DC circuit for so long, he had this amazing and like encyclopedic knowledge of the circuit's case law. Like the first case I did with him, there was a standing issue in it and sort of a question about whether the harm was imminent enough to give rise to Article III standing. And I had written this very confident memo that turned out to be completely wrong, totally mortifying. And not that he was very nice about it, but I felt incompetent. And I came into his office. It's like, you need to look up, I think Judge whomever wrote a case, you know, in the late 1990s that involved an elephant in a zoo. What? Just go find that. And so I did my sort of Westlaw searching. And sure enough, there was a standing case about imminence in the Article III injury context, some like conservation case or something that involved an elephant in a zoo. And so that was the level of precision he was able to work with. And so it always felt like we were trying to keep up with him a little bit.
Well, then from your clerkship, you went to the Georgetown Appellate Immersion Clinic, right?
I did, yes.
Can you tell us a little bit about the clinic, kind of what it does and your experience there? It sounds like an amazing place.
It's a really special place to work and hopefully place for students to work as well. It's the Appellate Courts Immersion Clinic, and immersion is literal, that when the students are enrolled, that's the only course they take for credit. It's their entire credit load for the semester. They basically run a public interest law office staffed by the supervisor, Brian Wolfman, who's a superstar. He's amazing. I learned so much from being around him. Two fellows and then eight students. And because you have the students for 40 hours a week, the clinic does really complex, interesting, multi-issue appeals. Sort of the canonical case that the clinic takes on is a multi-issue opening brief in a federal court of appeals. I did one bottom side, respondent side brief when I was there. It doesn't happen a lot because we tend to represent David in the David and Goliath fights. And David usually doesn't have very good counsel and loses in the district court. But cert stage stuff, amicus briefs, all kinds of things. But the opening brief in the Federal Courts of Appeals is really the heartland. And the subject matter varies super widely. Tends to be civil side, not criminal experts. But I did Family Medical Leave Act, Title VII, habeas, prisoners' rights, really interesting constitutional challenge to solitary confinement procedures in Arizona State Prison, federal sentencing and the enforceability of appeal waivers, immigration law, and those were just the cases I touched, which is fantastic for the students because they get exposed to a real array of issues. And it's great for the fellows too, because for somebody who is 1 year out of law school, I mean, I was counsel of record. I got 4 arguments in 2 years. Brian is really serious about supporting and helping his fellows, but really trusting them. When clients called, they called me. I was their lawyer. And when a case was going to be argued, I argued it. And that level of responsibility when you're out of law school, I think was a really, really special thing.
It really is.
How does it find the cases? Do the cases kind of come to the clinic? Do y'all seek them out?
All of the above. We take appointments from federal courts of appeals. I took several cases from the Seventh Circuit. The Ninth Circuit has a really awesome program where they pull out cases specifically for law school clinics. And with the condition that a student argue them, I supervised one of those cases and my student got to argue in the Ninth Circuit. He did amazing. It was so cool. To second chair an argument was really neat. I think it's harder than first chairing because I'm a control freak.
You just have to write your notes and
pass the notes over the table.
When I argue, I tell whoever's with me, like, don't pass me a note unless I'm going to lose the case if I don't say it. You're going to freak me out. I tried to be conscious of that and he did a fantastic job. It was a fantastic experience.
Broader reason we wanted to have you here today was sort of talk about public interest law and kind of your experiences and maybe for people, we haven't really had anyone on here to kind of talk about that piece of the law. So maybe let's start kind of with the terminology. I have heard a lot of different groups and people sort of say, oh, we do public interest work, but I don't know that there's maybe a uniform definition. When you think of public interest work, like how would you sort of define that?
The first sort of professional category I would exclude are government lawyers. And that's not a normative statement. It's a descriptive statement. like law school career offices, when they talk about public interest, they're distinguishing from big law. And so they're saying, you know, sort of firm recruiting over here, government and other public interest work over there, which makes sense, I think, for a career office to draw the lines that way. When I say public interest, I mean groups that represent people who need help, usually for free or perhaps on contingency sometimes, but generally the folks who need help, you're not asking them to pay in upfront, and usually in a David and Goliath posture. We tend to be suing the government or suing employers or other organizations, institutions that are harming people, usually individuals. So that's sort of my conception. When I call myself a public interest attorney, that's what I mean. I know people use it in all kinds of different ways and people have all kinds of different understandings. But when I describe myself as a public interest lawyer, that's sort of the family of work that I'm thinking of.
I heard you kind of describe the Appellate Immersion Clinic as a public interest law firm. When you say public interest law firm, for me, the picture of law firm is almost like a private firm. How does that work in the public interest space?
I think definitely as describing the clinic, the law firm is sort of an easy moniker for people to understand that they're working 40 hours a week. There's a hierarchical structure between the students analogized to associates and the supervisors analogized to partners. I know there are, I don't know as much about that corner of the public interest space. I know there are firms that will describe themselves as sort of public interest or like plaintiff side. I think those things can blur occasionally, but there are at least some firms that I think do kind of a mix, like they want to represent folks who can't pay or at a significantly reduced rate. And that's a big important part of their practice, but then they keep the lights on by doing sort of more traditional commercial litigation. And what would distinguish that from ordinary pro bono work is maybe how much of the firm's time is dedicated to that first group of cases. But I've actually never worked in that space, so I don't want to step outside my lane.
Well, you may be a relatively young lawyer, but that's a very wise position to take because so many people are more than happy to step outside their lane. So I respect that answer greatly.
You sort of have shifted, you know, you started out doing more on the appellate side, it sounds like public interest, and now you're kind of doing litigation. How does public interest practice work in the appellate arena in particular? I feel like that's a particularly difficult place to be. I mean, as the appellant anyway, the odds are not in your favor. And then when you're sort of representing David against Goliath in the appellate system, I feel like that adds another layer of difficulty.
I'll start from sort of what I learned by going to Georgetown and starting off my career as a public interest attorney as an appellate specialist. And then I'll back into what I think I'm learning now at CARE by joining a more well-rounded group that litigates all the way through. I think when I was at Georgetown, I became very in touch with the limitations of a closed record. When you're representing a plaintiff, especially if they come to you for the first time on appeal, you haven't been involved in the case, somebody loses in the district court, and you think they have a shot at winning the appeal and you take the case. In that posture, you don't know how well the case has been counseled before. You don't know if the case was counseled before, and you have no control over what's in the record. You also have no control over what claims were raised in the district court. It could be an immensely frustrating experience to see cases that, you know, we took because we thought they were winnable. It's not to say these were not winnable cases. Every case that the clinic takes, they take because they think they can win it. To see the missed opportunities. If the case had been counseled well from the ground up, what could have happened? And I think this was some of the cases that my co-fellow Maddie Meth, who's amazing, and Brian took, they did a lot more work with co-counsel than I did. And so Maddie actually had many cases with like very sophisticated, well-developed records. This is not to say that this is true of every case that the clinic takes, but in doing a lot of work on behalf of people in prison, you do a lot of cases where folks were litigating pro se, often from really restrictive circumstances. You know, they're in a cell 23 hours a day. So no, they're not getting declarations from guards. They weren't taking depositions. They can't describe the conditions in the different solitary confinement wings because they're only in one and they're not allowed out of it. Imagining the record that I wish I had had and wishing that I could sort of do more for my clients who would call me and describe, you know, what they were going through. It's like, I wish I could get that in front of a court. I think impressed upon me that it's extremely difficult, maybe prohibitively difficult, to be a true appellate specialist if what you want to do is help people whose civil rights have been violated by the government, because there's such a shortage of lawyers taking cases at the trial level and before in the case development stage, that you're needed early. And I exempt from this appellate defenders because they're sort of part of a whole hierarchical system that shepherds the cases through the trial courts and then the courts of appeals. I did a job search not all that long ago, and I'm just not aware of that many, if any, true appellate specialists in public interest law. And I think this is why, because cases get won and lost at the ground level. And now being at CARE, I think the learning curve has been not so steep in some things. If you can write an appellate brief, you can write a motion for summary judgment. They're not that different, but it's incredibly steep in other ways. For example, I have so much to learn about discovery. I know what I want a record to include, but I have no idea how it gets in there. And my supervisors are very patiently assigning me, like, why don't you write the first draft of a written discovery request? And it's like taking me 2 weeks and I'm having panic attacks because I have no idea what those look like. Because that sort of thing doesn't make it into the trial record. That's getting passed between counsel at the trial court level. The only things I know about trial practice right now are the ones I saw reflected on the docket. And there's so much of trial practice that doesn't hit the district court docket. And that's what I really am trying to absorb now imperfectly and with much patience from my superiors. And I also think I'm learning how much can and should happen outside of court. As I mentioned at the top, we have a form on our website and folks come to us and say, hey, something is happening to me. And sometimes the best vehicle to solve that is a lawsuit. Oftentimes it's not. Sometimes it's a letter saying, just so you know, you should probably stop doing this thing that could get you into trouble. And a lot of people don't, and institutions don't want to violate the law. And they think, oh my goodness, and they stop. Or oftentimes when people are in employment situations, retaliation is illegal, but it's a real worry. Maybe there's strategizing that happens about interfacing with less extreme remedies than immediately filing a charge with the EEOC. That kind of counseling and strategy about what's best for the client, not just issue spotting, how do I win this lawsuit, is going to be a big source of growth for me, I think.
For most clients, a supersedeas bond is something they may need once in a lifetime, and very few surety brokers specialize in supersedeas bonds. If your client needs to stay enforcement of a judgment in Texas, or any other state or federal court, Court Surety Bond Agency is the company to call. Learn more by visiting courtsurety.com today. In the public interest sphere, I would think, and I don't know about CARE, but do you run into a lot of issue conflicts where, for instance, you're on one side of a particular issue that you want to push forward in the courts and maybe have clients that come in with sort of different lawsuits that may impact that negatively?
No, I don't think we have conflicts in the traditional sense. We're representing Verizon in this case, and AT&T wants us to take this case. That sort of thing isn't going to happen. So there's infinite strategic considerations that go into deciding whether or not the organization takes a particular case. Winnability is one, but it's not the only one. We're a small group that punches above our weight. We are 6 lawyers and 3 paralegals right now. Some of it too is a winnable case, but is it worth the opportunity cost of maybe there isn't really grounds for an injunction here and damages would be pretty minimal versus on the other side, we could force this government entity to change their policy around people being allowed to wear hijab in the workplace or something like that. That would be something we'd be really excited about because we could have a more systemic impact. And I would expect that a lot of public interest organizations do that kind of balancing, which tends to be driven by resource constraints.
In the kind of current federal court climate, how much of a worry is the concern about setting bad precedent?
It's more significant than it was in the past. It's something that responsible practitioners think about, but it has to be balanced against, you know, your obligations to your client. And I think like at CARE, you're representing a client from the ground up. You've developed the lawsuit, you have your attorney-client relationship, you bring the lawsuit in the district court, and your client loses on a contestable, winnable issue in the courts of appeals. In my personal opinion, I am not speaking for anybody else, you have to take that appeal. You can't spike your client's rights because you're afraid of what could happen in the courts of appeals. To me, that's a dereliction of duty. I think that calculus changes very significantly if, as a lawyer, as an organization, you're looking for cases to bring legal issues in the courts of appeals as an impact litigator that's coming in after the district court, or you're cooking up a strategy to try to put specific legal issues in front of the court. I think the calculus is very different there when you don't have a pre-existing attorney-client relationship.
And that is one of the areas that when you think about public interest, I kind of think about that impact litigation side of it too, which it sounds like is very different from what your organization does.
It's somewhere in the middle, I think. We are focused intently on really individual representation. We're not at the moment sort of strategizing class actions or similar. We tend to, members of the community come to us and sometimes they have a need that affects other people and that can affect litigation strategy. But, you know, we do look for certain kinds of cases. We'll hear from the community. We're concerned that X has been happening more and more in interactions with law enforcement, for example. And you'll think, okay, that's something to be on the lookout for, if you will. But I think that's different than sort of a concerted, like, multi-year push to change the law in X way. And sort of the more pure impact litigation groups, I do think, do something a little distinct. But it's a spectrum. It's not, there's aspects, I think, of both sort of pure individual representation and impact litigation.
It seems like there might be some relationship between that sort of cautious approach at times to the cases that go up on appeal and your observation that you can have more impact in if you're dealing with a case from the ground up. Because I started, when you were talking about that before, I was thinking about, well, but what about those legal issues? A lot of these areas, the law, I don't want to say it's completely well settled, but you know, you are dealing with and somewhat restricted by the state of the law as it is. And I can totally see how that you can use that appellate part of your brain to make sure you have the record that you would want to see if a case does go up on appeal. That's a kind of a neat viewpoint to be able to apply to those cases.
I think that's exactly right. And I'm really glad you made that point, because I think there can be a despair among law students, young public interest attorneys, looking at the current federal courts and thinking, well, how can I do any good? I dreamed of going to law school and like winning these incredibly sweeping court of appeals or Supreme Court decisions, changing the legal landscape for millions of people. And if that's not going to happen, what good could I possibly do? And in my limited experience, I feel very strongly that lots and lots of bad things happen to vulnerable people that are clearly illegal under existing law. And they need your help to vindicate those rights. And you don't need to persuade a federal court to invent a new facet of a constitutional right in order for somebody who has been hurt to have that wrong at least partially remedied in the courts. And they're not going to be able to do that without a lawyer because they don't know how. And it's not as sexy, maybe. You're not going to be marching down the steps of the Supreme Court in your suit. But every day, people wake up and they're hurt by the government or other powerful groups in ways that you don't need any legal innovation to understand why it was illegal. And I think that's sometimes lost in the extremely important and valuable discussions about sort of the changing nature of the federal courts.
I very much appreciate that perspective. That's a great way to put it and a great way to think about it. When I went to law school, and even talking to people who are in law school now that maybe have an interest in public interest, law schools don't do a great job of maybe educating people about what it is or where the paths are for that. If someone is listening and is interested in maybe going into public interest, what would your advice be on sort of how to find a path into that?
It's tricky and it's both correct, but when you think about it, at times understandable that law schools aren't maybe as supportive as they could be for students going into public interest, because it's really easy to explain and facilitate the government honors process hiring. They do the same thing every year and you know what the application looks like. Same thing for big law. You know what the rounds of interviews look like and you can help coach students. You know what day you're supposed to show up at what hotel and what stuff to say and what stuff not to say. It's a really easy thing to hold an info session about. Public interest is harder because it's a little more catch as catch can. Organizations are small and they have limited funding, and permanent positions open up when they open up, which is sometimes not very often. So what happens then is there's this really challenging and unstable and underpaid round of early career fellowships that are sometimes externally funded, you know, the SCADNs, the Equal Justice Works, so on and so forth, sometimes are sponsored by the actual organization. But these super talented, motivated young attorneys show up and they're given a check for peanuts and they work for 1 year, 2 years, and then they're pushed out the door and they have to take their resume and find somewhere else to work. And that happens for years and years. I feel extremely lucky to have only done one fellowship. And it was a nerve-wracking decision to say, I'm qualified to be a staff attorney. I'm not going to submit applications for more fellowships. I'm going to hang on and see what staff attorney jobs open up. And it worked out. And I'm so glad to be at CARE LDF. But that was a white knuckle process because they're not hiring a year in advance. They're not hiring 6 months in advance. They're hiring when the funding hits the bank account and when the job opens up. I spent some time fielding what are you doing next questions with increasingly crazy eyes when people would ask me. And I'd have to say, I know it's March and my fellowship ends in July, but I don't know yet.
Maybe increased level of anxiety coming up with every passing month as well.
Yeah. And it can be really, I mean, it can be geographically unstable. Folks might have to move different cities, which can be very challenging, especially if you have a family. They tend to not pay very well. There's a lot of talk about like financial instability in public interest law. And I think that's right. You take a huge pay cut as compared to law firms and even a fairly significant pay cut, usually from government work, at least for the first couple of years. But the sort of career instability of not being able to plan more than 1 or 2 years out and having application cycle early in your career, I think can be extremely stressful and preclusive for people. And I think that's a big challenge for public interest attorneys. I've said all the stuff that's hard about it and I don't have any solutions.
Well, Hal, just continuing that point very briefly, after a certain number of years in public interest work, I mean, does it stabilize somewhat for the attorneys who've had more years of experience?
The holy grail is a staff attorney job, because once you have a staff attorney job, then you're set and that's a permanent position at the organization. Thrilled and delighted to finally be a member of the staff attorney club. And that's the dream. That's the goal. You don't want to be on the never-ending fellowship churn. I'm very glad to be done with.
You've talked a little bit about the challenges, and I think I may know what you're going to say, but you know, what are sort of the pros of public interest to you?
Oh my gosh, everything, every day. It's the biggest privilege in the world to wake up every day and feel like I get to, as my job, help people. It's something I actually never even imagined, like as a child. I always had an inkling that I wanted to be a lawyer and that I wanted to help people, but I couldn't pin down how that would happen. I think I had very abstract notions of, like we were talking about earlier, affecting sort of systemic change. And I don't think I even imagined how meaningful it would be to just like interact with people who need help. And sometimes you can't help them and that's really hard, or you try to help them and you fail. But what you can do and you can control is you can listen and agree that what happened to them was wrong and it shouldn't have happened. And you believe them and you care about them and you're going to work really hard to try to help them. And then you do everything you can and you hope that stuff falls the way it should. Can sound kind of dour or stressful, but I find it joyful because it's very, very meaningful. It makes me feel like I'm doing some tiny little speck of good in a sea of injustice, which is all we can try to do.
You really are, though, because you're vindicating and you're giving a voice to people who maybe traditionally have not had one. And that's an incredibly important thing.
Well, and it comes across, too, in the way you describe your job and when you're able to help someone, that feeling that it gives you. I mean, our listeners can't see you on screen like I can, but I just see the smile on your face and hear the excitement and sort of joy in your voice. And even just thinking about the prospect of being able to help someone who otherwise they couldn't help themselves, as you were pointing out earlier, because they don't know how. That's really neat.
I've been so struck by people who come forward to vindicate their rights in court tend to be very brave. It's a hard thing. If somebody who's incarcerated, if you're somebody who has experienced discrimination on the job, the dangers at times to vindicating your constitutional rights are not zero. In fact, they sometimes can be quite significant. And I also think that sometimes folks miss, and I don't want to sort of imply by saying that folks would struggle to help themselves. You know, people can be incredibly sophisticated and knowledgeable about their rights. Pro se litigants, I think, sometimes are sort of clowned on by the legal profession, which is fair. You've spent some time in a clerk of court's office, but several of my clients who are incarcerated have significantly more sophisticated understandings of the PLRA and AEDPA than most law students and most lawyers. There's also at times of a sort of privilege of collaboration where somebody knows, they know their rights, they know what happened to them, they know why it was illegal. And sometimes it's as basic as like formatting those arguments in a brief that looks professional that a court won't roll their eyes at instinctively. And you can sort of get them in front of a court and like help them speak for themselves, which I also think can feel very powerful.
I'm looking to see what else we have on our list. Let's see. We've touched on this a little bit, but how has the transition from appellate practice to trial practice been for you? One of the things that I have always done, both when I was a young lawyer and now when I'm mentoring young lawyers, is anyone who wants to do appellate work, we make do trial work. And I feel like trial work's incredibly valuable to learn that perspective, because it's very easy if you only do appellate work to kind of Monday morning quarterback what the trial lawyers are doing all the time until you've actually been in the trenches and sort of seen those judgment calls that are sometimes just split second. I mean, how has that experience been?
Yeah, I was going to say, I think it's going to make me a lot more humble in Monday morning quarterbacking a trial attorney's work. I think it's emphasized how much I have to learn about the legal profession, how to vindicate people's rights in court. I did not appreciate how much time is just spent fighting over who gets sent what documents.
Yeah, wait till you really get into discovery stuff.
I know. I'm so scared. My supervisor keeps telling me that he's not just going to let me spend all my time on Westlaw, and he's going to make me a well-rounded lawyer, whether I want to or not. I anticipate some discovery disputes in my future.
I was laughing a little when you were talking about having difficulty drafting discovery requests. I do think it's interesting because my experience is kind of like Jody's. I mean, I had the benefit of training up sort of with one foot in both worlds, and that I found to be very beneficial. I do remember being a young lawyer and not really being able to tell which way was up when it came to drafting discovery requests.
I have no idea what to say. I'm like, please give me the stuff that's relevant. Come on. You know what I mean?
I am very grateful to pretty much be out of that world now. I can go to the young lawyers down the hall and say, hey, guys, I need some discovery. On the rare occasion that happens, that I actually need that in one of my cases.
I definitely karmically willed this upon myself because I had this incredibly tasteless joke when I was so confident that I was going to be an appellate specialist forever and I would never dirty my hands with trial work, that if somebody asked me if I was ever going to do work other than appellate work, I would flip my hair and say, I'm too pretty for discovery. Here I am. I am not, in fact.
Has that worked to maybe avoid a motion to compel? Have you called the other side and used that line on them?
Not yet, but it's in my arsenal for sure.
You can tell them you'll win on the law. I'll beat you on the law. You may be better at fact discovery than I am, but I'll get you. That's awesome. Well, Hannah, it's been a pleasure to visit with you today. And we do want to follow our tradition, which is to ask our guests for a tip or a war story if they have one to offer to our listeners. Do you have something for us today?
I've been trying to think of war stories, and so far my practice has been relatively uneventful. I think the only thing I have approaching a war story is the one time I've ever been part of a Supreme Court filing. We filed a cert petition and the editing process sort of went off the rails a little bit, and we had been passing the draft back and forth, and then it was in my hands for final formatting, and it had to get to the printer by 10 a.m. because the hard copies need to go to the court. It's a very regimented process. And I was weeping at my computer because I do not understand Word formatting. And the clinic doesn't have paralegals. If somebody needs to change the margins on a document, it was me as the fellow. And I was like hysterically crying because I had no idea how to change this template. And I can see the clock like ticking down. And I'm on the phone with my boss, like, can you call the printer and ask them if they can wait 45 minutes? Because everything's on the wrong page. And I'm going to look stupid at the Supreme Court and embarrass the Georgetown. And I'm so sorry. And he was like, it's going to be fine. Hannah, take a breath. It's fine. We got it filed. It worked out. But I am not like a last minute kind of gal. I just sent my supervisor a draft of a brief that's due in like 4 weeks. Like, I do everything. I fear deadlines and I respect them. That was an experience I'm not eager to repeat.
Oh, gosh. Well, that's a good one. And I'll tell you, you are not alone in having that feeling at some point in time or another. I think every appellate lawyer has that moment of panic, wondering if they're going to meet a deadline. But ours usually aren't at the U.S. Supreme Court. That's a good one.
My palms are a little sweaty thinking about it.
Just the memory.
Well, thanks again, Hannah. We sure have appreciated visiting with you today, and you've been gracious with your time. And we really enjoyed hearing your perspective about what you do. I think it really be beneficial to the folks that listen to our show.
Well, thank you so much for inviting me. I was very, very flattered. Hopefully, you know, only a couple of years out of law school, so speaking a little bit off the cuff at times, but hopefully your listeners find it useful.
Thanks for listening to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast, presented by Butler Snow. If you're enjoying the show, please recommend it to your colleagues or leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. We appreciate everyone who has rated the show and otherwise supported us so far. To stay in touch, suggest topics, ask questions, or express interest in coming on the show, visit us online at texapplawpod.com or tweet us at texapplawpod. The views expressed by the participants on this podcast are their own and not those of their law firms, courts, or employers. Nothing you hear on this show establishes an attorney-client relationship or is legal advice.